So my name is Lydia White. I'm the Associate Provost, Policies, Procedures and Equity. And policies relating to reappointment and tenure fall in my domain. And today's session is a session about reappointment. So the process that you go through halfway through your, usually halfway through your position in on tenure track. Let me say now, before I forget, that we're actually planning a special session for assistant professors who are either about to go through reappointment in the coming academic year or who have just gone through reappointment, to look at or to help you think about ways to manage your research and teaching once reappointment is out of the way. So you'll be receiving an email announcement about this fairly soon. It's going to be on Wednesday, May the 21st in the afternoon. Okay, so what I'm going to...
Will there be a session for tenure?
The session for tenure happens in the fall. So in the fall, there's an information session about tenure. And you are most well, I sometimes say a bit about reappointment as well, but it's focused on tenure in the fall. You're most welcome to come in any year. You don't have to wait till the year when you are, you know, being considered for tenure. And many people find it useful to come a year or two earlier, so that you get some sense of what comes next. But I won't be talking about tenure today, except occasionally perhaps to show some contrasts between the expectations for reappointment and the expectations for tenure. And I think Laura will similarly...
Yeah, the other thing about tenure is MAUT has a tenure information session every year. I believe this year it's April 25th.
Okay.
So you can watch for that as well.
Okay, so... basically, we are going to be concentrating on reappointment, the relevant policies and the procedures at McGill. There are, in fact, I've only put up one set of regulations, but if some of you I know are librarians, there are the regulations relating to the employment of librarian staff and those relating to tenure track are available in the same place on the Secretariat website. And also, the Academic Personnel Office has a couple of pages which may help you with certain procedures, again, whether you are a tenure stream professor or a tenure stream librarian. I will make sure that these slides get posted, so you don't need to write all this down, but you will have access to the presentation afterwards. So what we're talking about for reappointment at two academic ranks, assistant professor or assistant librarian and associate professor or associate librarian, because we do have associate professors who are not yet tenured. But for full professors, even if they're not yet tenured, there isn't a reappointment process in the middle. In fact, it would help us just to know how, the easiest thing is, how many of you are, in fact, associate professors or librarian and are up for reappointment, not if you're on a committee. Is there, yeah, okay, so there's usually only one or two, and some of the issues relating to that rank are slightly different from the assistant professor or librarian rank. When are you considered for reappointment? It's in the final year of your initial appointment, and for most of you, your initial appointment was 3 years. Sometimes, because of when you started, it might be a little bit longer than 3 years. But your year of reappointment consideration is likely to be in your third year. And who is considering you for reappointment? We have several different levels of review. So there's a committee within your department, which is typically chaired by the department chair or the director if you're in a school or an institute. Let me say about the reappointments committee. In many departments, this committee is actually the same as the departmental tenure committee, but it doesn't have to be. So some departments will have a different committee looking at reappointment. Then that committee makes a recommendation to the dean of the faculty, and the dean in many faculties is advised by a faculty reappointments committee or committee for that kind of purpose. And then the dean makes a recommendation to the provost. So if you're in the situation of being in a joint appointment, are any of you in joint appointments? Yeah, okay, so several of you. You've got two departments and in some cases two faculties involved. And so the departments will be making the decision together. So if you're doing wonderfully in one department and terribly in another, this is somewhat problematic because both departments have a say in the reappointment consideration. And the chairs of the two departments agree amongst themselves to who is actually going to chair the reappointment committee. Similarly, if there are two faculties, the deans have to agree on their recommendation. So you can't have divergent recommendations in the case of joint appointments. So I just want to run through the timing of some of this. I'm taking assistant professors as the most typical case. So we'll look at the start date of your initial appointment and the end date. What does this mean for reappointment consideration? What does it mean for tenure consideration? So let's say your appointments, typically we now have two start dates, January the 1st and August 1st. There are some others as well, which I won't talk about. So let's say you started in January of 2013, then your appointment will be running to the end of 2015. So your third year is actually the calendar year 2015. Your year of tenure consideration won't be a calendar year, though. It'll be, in this case, the tenure consideration is your sixth year. It'll be 2018-19. The crucial thing to notice is if you start later in the same year, August 1st, your appointment's going to end at a different date, so your reappointment consideration is going to be different. It's going to be in an academic year, but crucially, your year of tenure consideration is the same as any colleague who started earlier or indeed later. Because the reappointment consideration, we count back from the end of your first appointment. For tenure consideration, we take the calendar year in which you started. So this is somewhat confusing to people. But at the moment, what you need to be thinking about is the year of reappointment consideration, your third year. So this is what I've just said. This will be your third year. And so what should you be doing at that time? Well, at the beginning of that year, or possibly somewhat before, you will be submitting a reappointment dossier to your department chair. Hopefully the chair will remember to ask you for it. But if they don't, make sure, talk to your chair, find out when does your department want to see your documentation. And your departmental reappointments committee will be looking at your case, your dossier, within 2 to 3 months of the beginning of the year of reappointment consideration. And then they will submit a recommendation to the dean, and as I said before, the dean will make a recommendation to the provost. And you will hear from the provost not later than 37 weeks before the end of your appointment. This is because in the case that the recommendation is negative, and this is quite unusual at reappointment, you have to have 37 weeks notice, so that's to allow for that. Are there circumstances in which reappointment consideration could be postponed in some way? And the answer is yes. So if you've had an authorized leave, such as a parental leave, a leave of absence, a disability leave, of longer than 3 months, you may request an extension of the initial appointment. Let me say here that in the case, if you have any kind of medical issue, please do take a medical leave and request the extension. Don't try and muddle through when you're feeling really, really sick and not up to par, and then subsequently say, oh, well, I wasn't really well, and that's why my performance is not so good. It's rather like the way we tell students they can't make retroactive medical excuses for poor performance in a course. You know, be upfront at the time, ask somebody for advice, but don't try and struggle through if it really is a struggle, because it could, not necessarily will, but it could set you back in a serious way. So in the case of reappointment consideration, this extension is something that you request. In the case of tenure, you actually have a right to choose it. And so you make the request, it's considered carefully, it's usually granted, and if it's granted, your appointment can be extended and reappointment consideration postponed into a subsequent period. And then later, we advise you not to make this decision right away, but later you can decide whether as a result of that postponement you would like tenure consideration to be postponed as well. So what are we looking for? What are the criteria? Well, first of all, you should have been given the criteria by your department within 2 months of starting your position. I'm sometimes hearing from these groups that this doesn't happen. If it hasn't happened to you, please go and see your chair. Because each unit, and you know, necessarily reappointment consideration differ from discipline to discipline and sometimes from department to department. So we ask the units to make it clear what they're expecting you to show when it comes to reappointment. These criteria are also supposed to cover what the expectations are for tenure. And the criteria will have been approved by the dean of your faculty, often a faculty committee, you know, to make sure that they're not unreasonably harsh or unreasonably easy, but something that's expected in the faculty in question. So the decisions that are being made about you as you come up for reappointment are based on your performance of academic duties. And so this is what the committees, all levels, will be looking at. And I'll get to what the actual duties are in a moment. But this is very important. In the case of reappointment, after all, you'll only have been at McGill for a couple of years. We can't expect you necessarily to have been able to achieve everything that we will be looking for at tenure. So one of the things that the committees will look for is, are you showing promise of meeting tenure criteria? And are you making progress towards meeting tenure criteria? The academic duties themselves, these are assigned to you by the chair or director of your unit, and they include teaching. And this one is really one where your chair or director will have assigned you, you know, here are the courses that you'll be teaching. Then there's your research and other scholarly activities, and we're not expecting, and indeed you should not expect, chairs and directors to tell you what research to do, not at all. Your decision in accordance with your career objectives. And then other contributions to the university and outside the university, this is typically called service. Here again, the chair may say, I would like you to sit on such and such a committee, and that would be part of your service. So that's for tenure stream professors. For the librarians, there are academic duties. They are slightly different. The last one is the same. The first one involves your position duties as a librarian, and then you have professional and scholarly activities, which can include research but don't have to, and then service. Let me say about librarians, in contrast to professors, librarians are for tenure expected to demonstrate superior performance in position responsibilities. We don't necessarily use terms like superior or reasonable for reappointment, but nevertheless, for the librarians, there is one academic duty that is rated higher than the others, or carries a greater weight, and that's not the case for the professors. So what are your responsibilities? It is your responsibility to prepare your case for reappointment. So establish that you've met the requirements as far as your department is concerned, based on what they told you in the first 2 months. Put your dossier together. And let me say here, and I might say it again, you know, putting a dossier together, and we'll see that the reappointment dossier doesn't have to be anything like as extensive as a tenure dossier, but this is something that you can do as you go along. Don't leave it to a month before it's due to put it together. I would say this particularly of the CV. What I do, whenever I do anything, I put it straight onto my CV. If you wait, never mind reappointment and tenure, merit consideration, keeping track of what you've done, just keep your CV up to date. It saves a lot of trouble. The other thing that we often talk about at both reappointment and tenure sessions is having a kind of, you know, a box or something into which you throw anything that might end up being useful, either as an aide-memoir or because you know that this should go in somewhere into your dossier. It doesn't mean that everything needs to go in, but it's just to remind yourselves, oh yes, I gave this talk, I sat on this committee, I reviewed this paper. You know, keep track of those things. So in the dossier, and this is true for reappointment and tenure, you need your CV. You will need a personal statement which covers your performance of your academic duties in quite some detail. In many ways, I would say these are the two most important things for reappointment. So in the personal statement, you are really laying out what you've been doing and why, what's good about it. Or if you've suffered any setbacks, what you're intending to do to correct those. Laura will talk about some of those with respect to teaching in a moment. So your dossier needs to include a record of research and scholarship and so on, and this may in fact be in your CV. Let me just say about record of research and scholarship. You should establish from your department whether for reappointment they want you to include actual PDFs of papers. For tenure, you will have to. A lot of departments don't require this for reappointment. They want a list in your CV, or a separate list of what you have done, but they don't necessarily want to see the actual work. So teaching, Laura will talk shortly about the teaching portfolio guidelines, and then some sort of record of your service. Again, this could end up being in your CV. And if there are other things that you want to submit, feel free to include them. For example, If you've had some difficulty in setting up a lab through no fault of your own, you want to make sure that your committee is aware of this. Now, in your department, people probably will be aware of this, but remember that your dean and the provost are also looking at your dossier, so put that kind of thing in. So we really are not expecting a detailed or extensive dossier for reappointment, but it should be sufficient for everyone to judge whether you're doing okay, whether you're on track. So as I already said, again, you should check what the practice is in your department. Certainly in my department, a CV and a detailed statement is taken to be enough for reappointment. And I've already said this, does your department want you to submit publications or not? So what are the possible outcomes? Well, I'm going to talk about the negative outcomes first. So we have an expression tending to the negative. And if a committee or the dean or the provost is tending to the negative, this applies to tenure as well as reappointment. First of all, you must be told in writing, and you must be given reasons why people are concerned about your performance. You must be given a reasonable time to prepare a response, that is, if you want to make a response. And you must be given the opportunity to meet with the committee or whoever it is, that you're allowed to present your case. You'd be surprised how many times a committee changes its mind on the basis of the meeting with the candidate. Because, you know, perhaps the candidate is able to explain things better, or things have happened between submitting the dossier and the meeting or whatever. So on the whole, I would say don't pass up on the opportunity of meeting the committee. So again, if you are not recommended for a reappointment, your appointment may continue for up to 1 year if you haven't already been given 37 weeks prior notice of the end of the appointment. And there is an appeal process, which I won't talk about. It's in fact very rarely used for reappointment cases, but it could be. It's more commonly used for tenure cases. So, but let me assure you, most of you won't be facing that situation. And as I've already said this part, you know, do address the committees, because it often succeeds in that making them change their minds. So for most of you, you will be reappointed, and the reappointment, the standard reappointment is for 3 years. However, some people get reappointed for a term that is less than 3 years, typically two and very occasionally one. And this is if there are concerns about your performance. Often it'll be concern about only one of your academic duties, and the idea is that you're being given a shorter reappointment really to show that in that time period you can bring that particular area up and then get the reappointment that would take you to the end of the 3 years. So I've already said, do plan ahead. Don't wait till the last minute to think about your dossier. You know, have it in the back of your mind all the time, what kind of things should be going into it. Crucial, don't be afraid to ask for advice from your colleagues, from your chair, from me. And if you get conflicting advice, please follow through and find out who's giving you the right answer, because sometimes people are giving you advice which turns out not to be correct. And probably the best person to ask in such cases is me. You know, I don't have a vested interest on the ground, but I do have a vested interest in seeing that our procedures are working in a fair manner. So when in doubt, please feel free to contact me. So I'm going to stop now. I'm not going to take questions yet. I'm going to allow Laura Weiner from the Teaching and Learning Services to talk a bit about the teaching dossier and expectations for the teaching dossier at the reappointment level. And then we'll have an opportunity for questions.
Hi. As Lydia said, I'm Laura Weiner, and I'm the Interim Director of Teaching and Learning Services. And you'll see at the end, I want to start by reiterating something that didn't know which mic was on. Something that Lydia said, which gather the evidence, keep records. And for teaching, it's incredibly important to keep track of things like I was on this committee to redesign a course. There's all kinds of things that if you can remember them all at the end of the year, let alone 2 years, I will be incredibly impressed with your memory. And you just keep a virtual shoebox or a physical shoebox, whatever. So there are regulations, written regulations, and again, as Lydia said, it's always good to go to the source when you're looking for the most up-to-date regulations. These were changed in February 2014, slightly, not radically, but they were changed. So somebody went through it last year. There might be something different. The Secretariat website is the official place for the most up-to-date version of any policy. And again, I would encourage you to go there rather than what your colleague who went through this process 2 years ago swears was the situation at the time. They may be right, but it may have changed. So the idea of a teaching portfolio, sorry, Jamie, is that you're trying to produce a record of your teaching, and it's teaching writ large. It's teaching, obviously, your classroom teaching. It's teaching in terms of your graduate or undergraduate supervision, depending on your department. You may be doing supervising one or more undergraduates. You may be supervising one or more master's students or doctoral students. It depends. Different departments have different policies for beginning professors. And everything that you've done at the university around teaching. So often people make the mistake of thinking, oh, it's only my classroom teaching. And that, of course, is usually the core, but it's certainly not all of it. And the key word here is concise. One of the main changes that was made to the guidelines was to really reduce the length of them. And as we all know, that makes it harder to write. And, you know, if I'd had more time, I would have written a shorter book. And that's why, again, it's important to start this process early. You're really trying to distill and communicate very clearly. And as it says here, you want to document the effectiveness, the scope, the complexity, and the individuality. And part of your teaching portfolio are facts. Again, I'll make these slides available as well with along with Lydia's, so feel free to, I'm an inveterate note taker, so feel free, but don't feel obliged. You want to show in what way you're being effective, what's the scope of your teaching. One of the real things is the individuality. Why is it different that I'm teaching this course or that I'm supervising these students as opposed to somebody else? And again, as Lydia said, for reappointment, you're applying at the end of your second year. In many departments, you have a very light teaching load in your first year, so you may not have a lot to talk about in terms of, oh, I've supervised all these students and I've taught all these courses, but you're trying to show the promise. So what you're really showing here is that you have thought about these issues, you have some experience, you've reflected on it, and you have a plan for how you're going to go forward. So if your first course didn't go so well, okay, it didn't go so well, I've consulted with colleagues, consulted with people at Teaching and Learning Services, what are you doing? I realize that there's all kinds of things, reasons why you may not get it right the first time. But the important thing is to show I've reflected on it. I think I now have an understanding of how I can move forward. And again, the progression will not be so great for reappointment because you don't have a lot of time behind you. Certainly when it comes up for tenure, that's a really important thing, which is another reason why you want to be keeping track of everything, because what is you're using for your reappointment dossier, you're also going to use as part of your tenure dossier. So you want to be able to show, well, in my first year, this is what happened, and look how far I've come, and this is these were the steps that I took. So the structure is really very straightforward. It's 5 to 10 pages. You're talking about your teaching approach, which is sometimes called a teaching philosophy or a teaching statement, your responsibilities, evidence, and again, these are concepts. Evidence isn't just numerical course evaluations, although those are part of it. And if you've been involved in teaching development and educational leadership of some kind, include that. The appendices would be documents that are explicitly referred to in the body of the teaching dossier. These can often be things like a teaching, a course outline that you're particularly proud of, that you think that you really showed some innovation or some thought. Sometimes it can be a set of comments from the course evaluations. It can sometimes also be an evidence of student work, something that you think really demonstrates the kind of learning that you're able to, learning environment that you're creating for your students. And again, these are brief artifacts. It's 10 pages, so you're talking about a maximum of 20.
Let me make it clear that those page recommendations are for the tenure dossier. Okay. And so for reappointment, you don't have to put in as much in the teaching teaching dossier.
Thank you.
What some people do for reappointment is, you know, take those headings but actually embed that into the personal statement and make a longish personal statement. So don't feel, you know, oh my God, I've got to think of 10 pages of stuff to say. You don't. And similarly, for the appendices, again, you might want to check with your department. Because again, for tenure, this is crucial, but for reappointment, you know, how much extra material does the department in fact want to see? There'll be variation across departments.
Thank you for that clarification. Yes, so these are maximums, and these are maximums for the tenure dossier. So you kind of scale back from there. In terms of the teaching approach, it's really answering the question of why do you teach the way you do. And there's, by the way, we have a stack of examples of teaching portfolios available at Teaching and Learning Services that are available for consultation. They're all from McGill professors who've received tenure within the last 5 or 6 years. So they're up to date. It can give you an idea. You're more than welcome to come by and look at them. And it's nice to look in your area. And sometimes it's interesting to look in other areas as well, because it can give you some creative ideas for how to communicate in the department. In the reappointment process, it's not so critical because you're really talking to your department, although the provost will also be reading it. In the tenure process, you're talking to people outside of your discipline. And here, it's really a statement about your philosophy of education. Why do you teach the way you do? What is your approach to teaching? What kind of learning environments are you trying to create for your students? And how are you assessing learning? How are you deciding that your students are learning? And again, these will be your graduate students in a supervisory relationship, as well as students in formal courses. So for the teaching responsibilities, courses taught, and for some of you who are, any of you who are doing clinical teaching, it's important to describe and quantify the interactions of, I supervise, you know, I was rotation, you know, I had 15 students who were rotating through my clinic, and what kinds of interactions, because that there can be such a range there that it's hard to know just by saying clinical teaching, clinical supervision, what that means. You may not have this as a relatively new professor, but it does happen that professors are hired and the first thing they do is you're going to develop a new course. Well, that's a big undertaking. And so you want to talk about that in terms of a responsibility. And what was your approach? What was your rationale for why you developed that course the way you did? How you think it fits into the curriculum? Aspects like that. And the other aspect is supervision, which is clearly considered at McGill to be a part of teaching. And some people will consider that as part of their research activities, but we consider your supervisory relationship with graduate and undergraduate students and postdocs to be part of your teaching responsibilities. So you're going to want to talk about how many students you're supervising, what your approach to supervision is, and that can be in part of your teaching philosophy, and what kinds of progress they've been making. For the evidence of effectiveness, course evaluations are the starting point in that you're required, or it's strongly recommended that you include the answers, the responses to the four core questions, which are common across the whole university. You can compare those to faculty norms, which are available on the website, in addition to the departmental means. The real point here is to look at the measures taken in response to feedback. You'll receive one of the real benefits of the online system is the quantity and the quality of written comments that you receive from students. And you can often get real insights into how you could make things better, how you can improve. This is another area where at Teaching and Learning Services, we're more than happy to meet with you. We do this regularly. Somebody comes in with their course evaluations, with their course outline. These are, you know, my frustrations, their frustrations, and we can help you sort of guide things, guide your teaching in such a way that you can address those issues. So that would be what you would discuss there. Students complained that the course was too high a level, and then you say, well, I realized that I was assuming a level of prior knowledge that didn't exist here, so I provided preparatory material, something like that. And there's dozens of ways that those can be addressed. And again, if you're supervising, provide evidence of how has that been successful. Have your students been presenting at conferences? Have they been publishing? Have they been, obviously, if they finish, that's a really nice thing. But just evidence that you're invested in their progress and that you're helping them to succeed. On the TLS website, if you go there, mcgill.ca/TLS course evaluations, there's all kinds of information on how to interpret them, how to get the faculty means, and again, we're more than willing to, happy to sit down with you and look at on a case-by-case basis. The one that's a little more amorphous for many people is the teaching development and educational leadership, and again, as you're applying for reappointment, this would not be expected to be as large a part of your dossier as would be looked for at the time of applying for tenure. But for instance, have you been investing in your own development as a teacher? Have you been attending workshops? Have you been participating in professional development activities for yourself? Have you been mentoring TAs or colleagues, or have you been mentored by a colleague? Have you sought out? Some departments have formal mentoring arrangements. Many don't, but many professors will, junior professors will seek out, identify a senior prof in their department who has a reputation for being a solid teacher and go and ask them for advice. Have you been on teaching committees? Have you made contributions to the curriculum committee? Have you been on some kind of working group? Sometimes there's an assessment working group or something like that. And have you been publishing on teaching? Again, this would not be expected for reappointment, but it's something that can happen for tenure, where somebody will be publishing on their experience of teaching in the discipline, not just publishing on research in the discipline.
I just wanted to add that this section is optional, yeah, both at reappointment and tenure. So some of you will not have had anything that you feel belongs there, and this will not be counted against you. But if you've got something there, probably be, you know, it's a bonus, so to speak. And then there are some things you'll think, oh, should I have this section or shall I put this information in one of the earlier sections? And that's your choice and it's fine.
And to reiterate what Lydia was saying, gather the evidence. You have a shoebox, virtual or physical, where you just keep track of, you know, who did you supervise, what committees you were on. Course evaluations now is relatively easy because they're online, so we keep track of those for you. You can always find those. It used to be that you had to file them yourself. What courses you've redesigned, whether it was a new course. Did you do a presentation about teaching, maybe to colleagues in the department, about a strategy that you've been using that was effective and people asked you to talk about it? So those are the kinds of things that are good to just jot down because you will forget them otherwise. And again, individual consultations are available, as well as sample portfolios to review, and we're also happy to provide feedback on drafts of the teaching portfolio, provided you call us more than the day before it's due, which we always get, well within a week. So we're very happy to look at drafts and provide feedback and help advise on how to present things, or if you're having trouble getting started with how do I write this thing called a teaching statement. But just please give yourself time to think it through and don't wait until the week before it's due. So you can always just email tls@mcgill.ca and your query will find its way to the right person. So with that, now we open it up to questions, right?
So thank you very much, Laura. Yes, so now any questions from the floor? And remember, if you are going to ask questions, please use the microphone nearest to you.
Yes, I'm Lisa Munter from the Department of Pharmacology and Therapeutics. I think my tenure year starts this year.
Your tenure
year? No, my reappointment year, sorry.
Yeah. Okay.
Jesus. My question, I was told that the reappointment meeting itself consists of a meeting of my mentor, the chair, and myself, so there will be no committee. Is this...
I have no idea what the practice is in your department.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, I think it's possible that in some departments there's a committee of one, which is the chair. You've mentioned two people other than yourself. It's unusual. It seems to me it's unusual that the first meeting should involve the candidate. But what we've been giving is a kind of sense of what is perhaps more normal practice in the university. But this is a large university with 90 different departments, and
okay. People
do things in different ways. So there's nothing wrong with it being done that way.
I was just curious.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah. Yes.
Hi. Excuse me. I'm Rachel Schaps. I work in HR in the Faculty of Medicine. I've been getting a lot of queries about the French program and how it, with all of the new changes in the immigration requirements and taking French in addition to obviously building your dossier for reappointment and tenure. I didn't know if you could comment a bit more on that.
Well, I can comment a bit, although I'm not the associate provost that deals with immigration issues. But we did make a decision, and it's on our website, and people have been informed, that if in your first 2 years as an assistant or an associate professor, you take at least 200 hours of French instruction at McGill, we will count that as equivalent to, in some sense, the 3 months leave that allows you to ask for a reappointment deferral. So at the level of reappointment, that's really the only relevant thing to say. What you cannot do is come when you're due for reappointment and say, well, I want to do 200 hours, so can I defer? No, you've got to show that you've been doing it. We recognize that with the increased demands on French proficiency, this is taking time, and that this can impinge on your, probably on your research time, right? So, so we are trying to make adjustments, and the adjustment we have at the moment is, do it, and then we will give we in the first 2 years, and we will give you an extent. We'll recognize that you may have lost time. Now, we've heard people say they've done that and decided they didn't need the extra time, and we've heard others who've asked for the time. So it goes both ways. Yeah.
I may have a question that really only applies to me, but the makeup of my job actually has very, very little formalized teaching. Most of the teaching that I do is informal.
Could you say what department?
Oh, I'm so sorry. Meredith Young, Department of Medicine and Center for Medical Education.
Okay.
So I was just wondering, because of the bulk of my teaching being non-traditional, either one-on-one mentorship of people trying to develop research projects or careers, or actually teaching at the faculty level, so doing capacity building and workshop series, the formalized documentation of efficiency is very different, if non-existent, for a lot of that teaching. So I was just wondering if there were other examples besides the formalized, centrally collected evaluations of efficiency that have been used in the past.
That is a you are in an almost unique situation, I think. Yeah, I think we can speak offline, but a lot of what was talked about in terms of the supervision and the informal, that's not part of your responsibility, so because you don't have it, it's not going to be held against you in any way. But we can talk at another time about ways that you can document that and discuss it.
Sorry, my name is Giovanna. I'm a librarian, and it's sort of same comment to the other situation across the room, because we don't teach credit courses. A lot of the courses, the workshops and lectures that we give, they're embedded in class or outside of class. They're usually one-shots. So we have evaluation forms that we give out, but there's nothing like the website that you described. So it's sort of a similar situation. I was just wondering if maybe you want to comment on it briefly, if there's other ways of demonstrating effectiveness when it's not a three-credit course or more credits.
I think in the situation of librarians who are often working very closely with professors, that there are ways of gathering evidence of your input into professors' courses. For instance, examples of how you supported certain assignments in certain courses or supported the development, working with professors to integrate the library into their assignments or document the role you played in their courses. There are ways of documenting that within that credit structure, and then the non-credit structure is a similar thing where you're keeping track. Most of the librarians I know do evaluations of the workshops that they are giving on a non-credit basis directly to students. But I think when you're working closely with professors, then there are ways of getting information from the professors and in ways of showing how your work supports the work of the course. And that can be through the course outlines, how the assignments are structured. So that can be something you can discuss and then show perhaps one example of.
Okay. Thank you.
What I said was, I see there are some department. I can see at least two department chairs, and I wondered if either of you have any perspective to offer from the point of view of what you, as a chair, would hope to receive, or what kind of mentoring you might be giving to junior professors, or whatever. Sometimes it's useful to hear, what happens at the different levels. So since nobody seems to have any question, Craig.
Craig Mandato, Anatomy and Cell Biology. I think concise is good. You mentioned that don't bury us with paperwork, because when I did my reappointment and tenure dossier, I was told put as much paper as you can in there and do not do that. I can speak from example. Do not do that. Be concise. Give us the CV and stick to the points.
I think you made it pretty clear what one needs to do. So one just needs to listen and do it. That's and I guess the other part is, it's this time of the year right now when chairs, I guess, are doing merit increase. And so that is kind of yearly feedback in principle that a chair should give you, or you can go ask a chair, why aren't you getting top scores, essentially? Because that probably would be a very good hint what you might want to try and improve and things like that. The teaching, the other part is essentially is the mentoring part. So if your department doesn't formally assign you a mentor, pick somebody you like, that you respect, that has experience, and have them mentor you, essentially ask them directly about for suggestions. I think particularly what is challenging when you start as a young prof is this work-life balance, time management thing. You can excel in anything you want, essentially, if you dump 24/7 into it. Frankly, you'll not have 24/7 to put into teaching, into research, into services, and into your life. Essentially, you need to get a life. And so, balancing that is actually the challenging part, I think, because, you get messages from left, right, and center, you should be doing really well here and there and everywhere, and none of us have more than 24 hours a day, and we still manage to sleep sometimes. No? So I think just get a good mentor and get some perspective, and you'll all do well, I think.